Hi. Wow, first podcast. Welcome, everybody. My name is Christopher Butcher, and you have reached Mangasplaining, where we talk about manga and about recommending manga to people who maybe don't know that much or maybe feel like they don't know that much when it comes to manga. So, on that note, I wanted to take a second and introduce all of the wonderful people here on the Mangasplaining podcast. And since I am on the left of my screen, we're going to go right for the people who are on my screen. And first up is Deb Aoki. Deb?
Hi, I'm Deb Aoki. I read a lot of manga, and I write about manga for Publishers Weekly, a couple other online sites. I talk about manga a lot on Twitter. I guess that's kind of my qualifications.
Next up is the fabulous Chip Zdarsky. Chip is you write for a non-manga publisher, I hear.
I do, a little place called Marvel Comics. I've written a bunch of titles for them, some Spider-Man, some Howard the Duck. Currently I'm writing Daredevil for them. Wow. And doing a couple other things for their competition, DC.
You do that?
Well, just don't tell Marvel. That's the one thing I ask of everyone on this. Don't tell Marvel what's happening. Those are my qualifications.
And next up on my screen is the inimitable David Brothers. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I am a reformed comics critic, a former comics marketer, and current manga editor. So I'm failing in some direction. I'm not sure which yet. But it's a nice life.
It is. It is. And as I said, I'm Christopher Butcher. I have been writing about and reading comics for a long time and have worked in and around comics in lots of different ways over the years. Now we're all getting together to run this podcast, which is really exciting. And, you know, we've been talking about Deb and David, not so much Chip. David and I have been talking with, you know, about for a long time about, like, you know, manga's great. There's this amazing deep world of books, but it tends to look a little sheltered from the outside. It tends to look like it's like a hegemon, like, you know, hegemony maybe. Like it's just like this one walled, you know, garden that only the initiated can get into. And we'd been brainstorming ways for a couple of years. It's like, oh, well, how do we make this appeal to a wider audience? Not, you know, necessarily just superhero fans, because that's the sort of dominant paradigm on the other side of, you know, the comic book industry, but also like everybody. And what if we could start this with an everyman, like someone who literally knows nothing about manga? And what if we secretly invited him to be a part of a podcast that he didn't know was going to be about getting him to learn about manga? And that's why.
So who's that going to be?
That's why we've invited Chip Zdarsky, and he's going to be the canary in the proverbial
what?
Manga coal mines.
You son of a.
That can't be true, Chip. Right? I mean, you write comics. How can you avoid manga? It's like the 80-pound gorilla in the room in the comics.
Okay. Listen.
Explain yourself.
I was a sheltered lad in a small Canadian town, and I'm probably a lot older than all of you. I don't know. I'd imagine, and I don't think the manga boom didn't happen when I started like actively reading comics. So I was still picking up, you know, the Marvel books, and in my teen years with the Vertigo books. So it really just kind of passed me by, and I would eventually have a bunch of friends who were into manga, and they would try and get me to sample some things, and maybe I read like half an issue here or there, but nothing that really really grabbed me. It seemed pretty intimidating to get into kind of the whole world of it. Though I am an expert in American comics.
Of course.
So I feel I bring that to the table. I don't know what the rest of you bring to the table, what makes all of you able to judge me and my lack of knowledge. So please fill me in on why you should be my teachers.
Well, for me, the manga boom happened when I was in high school. So okay. As I was graduating high school, So I basically, you know, I was overseas for a little bit and came back to the States and manga was suddenly cool in like 2002-ish.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I would spend entire book checks at, or entire paychecks at Books A Million, just like going through all their manga and reading a bunch of, in hindsight, not great stuff.
Like what? I'm curious.
honestly, everything. Like, I was a very voracious reader, so if it was out and it was, like, printed backwards, I was picking it up.
Mm. I really
support customer. The industry.
Yeah.
But as a kid, I knew about, like, anime, like, Ninja Scroll, Fist of the North Star, Akira, I knew about those, but I didn't know that Japanese comics were a thing. Okay. But I had a couple issues of Marvel's Akira manga. I had a couple issues of Super Manga Blast, but they were all, like, they felt like American comics.
Yeah.
It's like they were in color and printed, you know, left to right. Mm. But ever since, as an adult, like, they've only gotten better and better as, like, my taste and, like, selection has improved. So and I think on account of reading a million manga, like, that's my qualification.
Yeah.
How about you, Deb? What makes you about dot manga?
I wrote the about.com manga site for a while before it faded away, but I've been reading manga all my life. I got introduced to manga when I was in third grade. Mm. Actually, earlier than that, when I made my first trip to Japan, my aunt gave me Nakayoshi, which is like a shoujo manga, girls' magazine. Mm. And I can't read much Japanese, but, you know, reading the manga, like, you can still understand what's going on in the story. And shoujo manga is like crack for a little girl, you know? It's got full of melodrama and emotions and fantasy and stuff. So, and it, you know, it's really big and thick and it comes with toys and stuff. So you really get into it. So I started to learn how to read Japanese because I wanted to understand the stories. I love the visuals. And I grew up in Hawaii, and Hawaii has a lot of Japanese Americans, so we had Japanese movie theaters with subtitled movies, and we had two Japanese radio stations and a Japanese TV station, so we could watch anime all the time. So it's like the 60s and 70s, you know. So I grew up with my schoolmates went to Kamen Rider and Kikaida, and I grew up watching Princess Knight. I just really loved manga, and then I think the first time I started to see manga in English, other than Barefoot Gen, was like in the 80s, and I bought everything. Because you could buy everything, because there wasn't that much.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, Lum, and like Ranma 1/2, and whatever, and then over time, more and more came out, like Lone Wolf and Cub, and then Akira, like we mentioned, Akira's in was in color, and it was flipped, and it was, you know, I had watched the anime, and so, you know, it's just kind of been, I guess, several years of my life has been into manga.
I can't help it. I gotta put my interview hat on for a second. Were you aware of manga as being a separate thing from, like, American comics, or anime as being a separate thing from American cartoons when you were watching them? Like, could you tell that they were Japanese, or was it just like, this cartoon is interesting, and this cartoon isn't, and I haven't figured that out?
At first, no. Like, for example, Speed Racer was probably the first anime I watched, and I didn't know it was Japanese because it was in English, you know. And, you know, the other stuff that I read, it was obviously in Japanese because that's the language it was in and had subtitles. Mm. But, you know, I'm being Japanese in Japanese American in Hawaii is a little bit like being surrounded by the ocean and you're a fish, you know. It's like, oh, it just is. You know, and I read both types. I read Richie Rich, I read Teen Titans, I was a big Legion of Superhero fan. I was kind of an omnivore, so I know enough about what's going on in American comics to understand some of the jokes, like, oh, is this, how many times is Jean Grey resurrected again, you know, like, I know all these jokes. I mean, and I read Daredevil, and like I read Lone Wolf and Cub, so I could kind of see, like, very similar. Mm-hmm. But, you know, knowing it's Japanese, it didn't occur to me till later as something special.
That's interesting, because by way of introduction to my expertise, It was the same thing. We watched a lot of cartoons. I could only watch educational TV, basically Canadian PBS, not even PBS, TV Ontario. That's for Chip. And so TVO. And so I could only watch stuff on there because my parents were terrified of gun violence. G.I. Joe really spooked them, I guess, or at least my mom. My dad did not care. So I found out later that a lot of shows that I liked, the big one was Fables of the Green Forest, which was a Japanese-French co-production that I've actually seen anime cells for when we've been to Japan. A Japanese production. And then obviously the stuff like Transformers, which was sort of a cross-production situation, was hugely influential. But then also Voltron and Robotech and, you know, all the stuff. I missed the 70s after school stuff that a lot of my older friends saw, the like Star Blazers and Mazinger. I don't remember what they called that.
Mazinga. I love that shit.
Yeah, those are the ones that I saw.
Gigantor.
Oh, but that's anime. Yeah. That's the other problem. Yeah. It's anime, and there weren't a lot of comics. I think Marvel did like one Shogun Warriors series, and that was kind of it. But from there it was when I was in middle school, I was way too young. A friend of mine slipped me a VHS. He's like, you got to see this. And normally that would be porn. Especially today, it would be porn, but it would just be a link. But instead, it was Akira. The North American, like, fifth generation, sixth generation copy of a copy of a copy of a copy on VHS. And yeah, of course, it blew my mind. Like, of course it blew my mind. I was like 13 or 12 or something. And then, of course, you show it to your friends and it blows their minds. But it blew their minds in a way that was like, we need to get more. Where I was just like, this is like some sort of beautiful, delightful artifact, right? They're like, no, we need more. So they used their sister's login to the University of Toronto. This is in like the, I'm going to say late 80s, early 90s. University of Toronto, they used their login to pretend, to the library, to pretend to be university students to access the proto-internet, the like Usenet forums and stuff like that.
Oh.
And they're like 12. And they're like, yes, I am an adult and I would like to. So they engaged in like really early fan subs and tape trading and things like that. So I think by the time they moved out to go to university, they had, I'm going to say 300 VHS tapes on LP, like on 8 hour, full of just like random episodes of stuff. Some of it had been fan subbed, some of it was raw. And then comics just became a part of that where it's like, oh, I saw that anime and I didn't know there was an Maison Okoku comic. And when I talk, we're talking anime, like we saw everything. Like it was just, we were watching it because it was anime, not because we cared about any individual story past that. Sort of like the, I'm going to read everything at the library or everything in the bookstore kind of format, like Dave, you were talking about. And it's just like, yeah, we just watched everything. And when there were comics, I was like, oh, this is really weird as hell. I remember reading an early issue of Manga Vision that had Legend of Kamui in it, a lot of Rumiko Takahashi because she was a really popular translation. And then I found out there were book collections of it, which was also kind of mind blowing because North American comics barely had trade paperbacks or graphic novels at that point. And that became the primary format for a lot of that stuff. And then from there, it was just my manga interest continued because it was like, oh, this is the industry that I kind of want. Like, I want an industry that's not 99% superheroes. And this is like, there's superheroes for sure. There's Japanese superheroes all over the place. But there's also like comedy and there's romance and there's all kinds of stuff. So that's when I started writing about comics, about the industry in general in like the late 90s. And when I started really thinking about what I wanted the comics industry to be. And manga was a huge part of that. So it's one of the reasons I have recommended manga and talked about manga so much is because I think that, you know, the more you see, the more you realize not everyone has everything perfect, but definitely in the industry, there's all kinds of stories, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that you can, there's a manga for everybody. And, it's one of those things where, well, I've trapped Chip on a podcast and we're going to find the manga for him is what it comes down to.
First of all, are you inferring that there's not a Marvel comic for everybody?
Don't tell CB, but no, there's not. There's really not.
All right, that's fair.
So there you go. So I guess back to you, Chip. Why do you think you haven't found the manga that's right for you yet? Have you read anything?
I've read bits and pieces. So in high school, my best friend was huge into manga and anime. You couldn't get a lot of it in our town. I think it was Viz, actually, that was the only company really kind of putting it out. Was that?
Yeah, that era.
Yes, sure. Yeah, one of the first. Yeah.
Yeah. So Rumiko Takahashi. Mm. Mm. I read a bit of Ranma, and a bit of Maison Ikkoku, and I liked them, but it's just not what I spent my money on.
Yeah.
Like my friend would show me some of it. I'm like, oh yeah, that's really fun. And then I would go buy another copy of Spider-Man. Or at that point, I was kind of moving into like, you know, the Vertigo stuff and some Fantagraphics. Mm. So it felt like a step backwards for me in a weird way to read like the kind of the bubbly cartooniness of the manga that my friend was showing me. Mm. So, you know, I was like, I was fine with him having it and I would look at it once in a while, but I just never got into it. And so it was the kind of thing where, you know, years and years later after college, when I started to get back into comics and joined a studio, like Kagan McLeod was in the studio and he had all of Lone Wolf and Cub. Mm-hmm. And it also just seemed daunting, like just the amount. Yeah. Like no one ever presents, oh yeah, here's all the issues of Frank Miller's Daredevil. I'm like, oh, how am I going to get into this? But with something like Lone Wolf and Cub, it's just like this massive brick, you know, that was on the shelf. And I would just like flip through or he'd show me like a fight scene. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. But it never clicked to me that this was also something I could read, you know?
It requires a different visual literacy, I think, too, that can be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, like I love the look of it. Mm. And I always enjoyed the stuff that I did flip through and read, but it also just felt like it had passed me by. Like I was too old for it too. Like that's the other thing. Just like, cause I wasn't really reading a lot of like the superhero stuff, the stuff that I write, like, at the time as well. Mm. Like I would read just kind of one-off graphic novels. Like I was like, I'm at the age now where I just read a story. Mm-hmm. And like I can't anything that's serialized, anything that's like 20 volumes, like it's just not for me because like I'm an adult now and I just read like grown up books.
Yeah, literally.
If they are comics. And yeah, you know, I think it definitely hampered me. Like I think if I had a greater range of influences, my storytelling could be better. So this is a little selfish on my part joining this group because I do want to get into the world and I need the recommendations and I need people to kind of talk me through it so I can actually become better at my job. Cause also from the sound of things, everyone here is well-rounded. Like you all talk about like, you know, you read the Marvel stuff, you read Richie Rich, like, and then also all the manga. So, everyone here is more well-versed in comics than I am. So it's time to take me to school, I guess.
A weird thing about that is that kind of, manga was my vertigo. Like, I didn't know about Sandman or Hellblazer when I was a kid. So these were, like, my alternative comics, in a way.
Yeah.
And as I grew, like, obviously I got into, you know, the Kieran Berger era and ones after that. But it sort of, like, had that, this is what I grew up into feeling for me.
Yeah, it depends on when the stuff came out and how old you were when it came out as well. Like I said, like, when I was getting into the vertigo stuff right when it was coming out and I was like 17, 18 and I had the trench coat.
That's the perfect time for that.
I had the Ankh necklace and I'm just like, okay, this is my thing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to order Guinness as soon as I know how to order Guinness to be like John Constantine. And at that time, like my friend's handing me a Ranma. And I'm like, there's no cool trench coats in here.
Yeah, that's kind of like switching between country western and like trance music. It's like,
yeah, and they're all, I mean, they're both can be equally good forms of music, but just there's a dissonance there, which you know, I think eased up a bit as I kind of went through art school, and like you study more art and illustration and various influences in class, but it wasn't enough to get me to actually kind of to follow my friends down the rabbit hole into the manga world. Anime, like college, you know, we like to have a few drinks and watch Sailor Moon. Like, we were addicted to Sailor Moon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, that was kind of like the college days. Like, this whether it was, like, ironically enjoying it or what, like, we would still enjoy it. But I didn't besides like some childhood anime stuff that I didn't really recognize as anime, like the Force 5 stuff, which was the Canadian repackaging of some of the Japanese.
Force 5. What's that? Is that the Go Ranger?
It's what Chris was mentioning earlier. What?
Star Blazers?
Battle of the Planets.
No.
The other one.
Wasn't.
This is why we have
Google. What were you talking about before?
Five different anime television series. It doesn't see what it included. It's all Toei shows. Mm-hmm. It is Guy King, Dengard Ace, Star Avengers, Grandizer, and Space Gateer.
Grandizer.
That was it. That was my total anime. Because I didn't even have Transformers or G.I. Joe. Those weren't shows that I watched. Mm. So those and Battle of the Planets, that was my entire anime childhood. Mm. And I didn't even understand that they were not produced in Canada.
Yeah.
Like, I just didn't have a concept of anything being produced elsewhere.
Yeah, the same thing.
It's kind of the same for me.
Mm. Yeah.
Sailor Moon and Savage Dragon used to come on the same programming block when I was a kid. And in 2020, Savage Dragon, like the adaptation of the Image comic.
Oh, really?
Wow. I think it was the USA Network. They had that in like Denver, The Last Dinosaur.
I didn't know that.
And it's such a strange pairing in 2020.
Yeah.
But it kind of shows how undifferentiated a lot of this stuff was at the time. Like, yeah. It wasn't anime yet, even though it obviously was, but it wasn't being marketed that way yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a cool cartoon.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, this cartoon looks better than the other cartoon.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a period of time when, like, there was nothing. A lot of the American cartoons were very kid-centric.
Yeah.
And anime was that rare example of, like, you know, animated content that could appeal to someone over, say, the age of 15. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a little more mature. It was more action-packed. It was more, I don't know, sexy.
Yeah, better drawn.
Yeah, so much better drawn.
Yeah, well, there's true.
I really feel like Batman the Animated Series was like the first American production, which was actually mostly animated in Korea and Japan, I think.
Yeah.
Where I was like, oh, this looks great.
Yeah.
Versus it being like my X-Men delivery system.
The cartoon I actually kept watching when I went into teenagehood and adulthood was Batman Animated Series. Even Batman Beyond, which was really gorgeous, I couldn't get into. But it was just like the right combination of like nostalgia for the character from growing up and like this massive loving the movies when they came out and loving superhero comics in general, and also like really smart, mature stuff. And the TV stuff I saw has the filler problem, the anime filler problem, where it's like, all right, spend the next 15 episodes for Goku powering up. And it's when anything happened, I would be really into watching Dragon Ball. When anything happened, I'd be really into watching Sailor Moon. But it was a little bit, it was for kids. Like, it was absolutely for kids. And I think the fact that it resonated, well, we could talk more about that for, you know, over the next several episodes of podcasts. But it's just the idea that, like, oh, there's finally something that, like, kids' entertainment is just made more complex, I think, in a lot of ways. Or was, certainly. I think there's a lot of good kid stuff out these days, or a lot better. Teen Titans Go is so good.
That's true. It's so clever.
I think, Chip, you might be the only one who isn't on the Teen Titans Go train.
I watched a bit of it when I was at Fraction and Kelly Sue's house.
Mm-hmm.
Because their kids watch it, and so it would just have it on the screen while, you know, breakfast was being served, and and Matt was like, this is actually an amazing show, and like the jokes were great.
They're so right?
They're sharp.
Mm-hmm. I'm not generally an animation fan, which is weird for when people find that out. Like, I don't watch animated movies really, because I find especially action and comedy I don't think works for me in that format, because the comedy is very telegraphed. And there's not a lot of natural rhythm to comedy in animation. There's a very specific type of animated comedy timing that kind of drives me nuts. And action, I'm just like, well, it's drawn. I don't care. Which is a weird thing for guys who make comics to say. But I can't watch CGI movies either because there's no visceral reaction in me when things happen.
Really?
I'm dead inside. I don't know what it is, but.
Is that like not being able to recognize faces or something? That sounds like some kind of disorder.
Oh, great. Thank you, Jeff.
No, I don't get it.
But it's kind of like how with Pixar movies, like I have to watch those with my younger cousins because otherwise I'm like, it's just my adult brain, like picking apart the plot.
You're kind of picking it apart. Like, yeah. As soon as you get into storytelling as a career, or become a professional critic, like, it's hard to just enjoy certain types of media because you are always, like, kind of reverse engineering it as you go. And I find with animation, it's more so. I get lost more in kind of real-life productions than I do animated ones. Yeah, that's I remember, this is, you know, I'm diverging here, but... years ago, I went to the theater, like a second-run theater, to watch, I think it was Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Ooh. And I'm watching it, and like there's the scene like with the tanks, and he's holding onto the tank, and the tank's hitting the rocks, and the rocks are shattering and stuff. And like it was the first time in a long time that I had an actual reaction in the movies watching something, because at that point, everything was so CG. Mm. Like you just sit there, and it's like things are bouncing and exploding, but none of it even feels real. But to watch an older movie where they had real stunts, you're just like, oh, okay. There's a natural feeling here. Where they used
real rocks.
See, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That you can feel the difference.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, wow. For sure. And like, so I never got into anime. So I didn't get into manga. I didn't get into anime.
Fortunately, there's a lot of live action anime that we can inflict on you.
Oh, good.
It's interesting, right? Because like even in drawing, like one of the things I think about with Vagabond, like by Takehiko Inoue, is that when he shows the battle scenes and when he shows like people getting cut, like sword fights, you can feel in the way that he draws that you can feel like the knife going through flesh. Like it has a weight to it. It has a definite tension to it that you don't get in like in Bleach where like these giant blades and whoosh, or like in One Piece where like you know like Zoro just cuts through an iron wall and it's like you know, and there's no sense of weight or physics to it.
Yeah.
you just kind of have to go, okay, well, I'm gonna just go with this. But with Inoue stuff, you can feel the fear of the fact that you could be cut and hurt, and there's this tension, and that's hard to express.
Well, it's interesting. I don't think we've actually mentioned it for the listener yet, but we all traveled to Japan together. So a lot of this kind of came out of like us going to these places, these kind of shrines to manga that I just didn't know or understand. But there was the one, the art show for the boxing manga. What was it called again?
Hajime no Ippo.
Hajime no Ippo?
Oh, good job.
Yeah,
Hajime no Ippo.
Okay, sure, yeah. And I was fascinated by those originals. Like, I don't think I've ever actually been moved by original comic art as much as I was looking at those. Like, obviously very cartoony, but like the feeling... that is recreated in the brushwork and like the gestural figures, like you felt the punches even though they were quite exaggerated. Again, much more so than I would if it was animated.
I think it's one of the things manga does really well that anime tries to do, but even when you do like a still frame or hold on something in anime, I don't always feel that it has the same feeling, like the same impact that the manga does, because so much of manga happens in your head when you're reading a manga. Like, even if you don't like act out the sound effects or hear the sound effects or the voices or whatever, there's like a visceral, like there's a translation thing that happens to like between the page and the and you as the viewer, as the reader, that I think is really interesting, that I don't think enough work has been done to research how that works for comics, or at least if it has, maybe it hasn't been translated into our.
I see that, right? Like there's something like I'll read both. I mean, I'll read Attack on Titan and I'll watch the anime, and Attack on Titan is admittedly horribly drawn, but when it's animated, it's super dynamic.
Yeah.
Or like sometimes I watch One Piece and I read. I've been reading One Piece as my pandemic read because it's like 1,000 episodes.
Yeah, they just hit number 1,000.
And I started in summer and it's like January and I'm still only at episode 700, right? So, but I watch it because, like, sometimes the way he draws is very compact, and then when you watch anime, the action is a little bit more. I can understand what's going on action wise because it's a little bit more spread out. So you can do both together and see how they're both different yet complementary. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel the same way with Haikyuu. Like, Haikyuu, like, the drawing is okay. The anime really drives home the action.
I actually like the drawing better on that one because it's rougher. Yeah? It's so much rougher and more gestural and loose. And the anime, I feel like, concretizes the look and the movement and things like that more. I haven't enjoyed the anime that I've watched, but I've read, I think, the first 7 or 8 of the manga and really enjoyed it. It's the other problem. Literally everything is available now. Almost everything is available now. And it's like, I should go back to Haikyuu, or I could read the other, like, literal infinity things I have access to right now. It's
too much.
For being a manga fan. But that brings us to the first manga that maybe we should recommend to Chip. And I got to admit, I'm biased, because for me, the big revelatory, like, oh, Japan is awesome, you know, thing, or anime, anyway, manga anime, was Akira, as I mentioned. And I did actually get to see the Akira comics a little bit later, and they were very different from this is the Marvel edition that was in color. Very different from the anime, and like very different from the anime in some ways, and very similar in another. And I think it's I think I didn't immediately gel with the comics as much because the anime was so like formative and foundational for like my understanding of like this kind of media. Even though now I think it's like one of the closest adaptations that you could do of the 3 volumes or whatever that were available at the time. But I think it's like what Deb's saying. It lies on the page differently than it exists in the animation. Katsuhiro Otomo is the author of Akira, and I want to do a good job on this podcast of like making sure to put artists and authors at the forefront of what we're talking about. So Katsuhiro Otomo,
are you saying artists aren't authors?
Yeah, artists, authors, all of the above. Man, when I was doing TCAF, that was a tough one. I settled on creators because that way I couldn't possibly offend anybody. But now it's content makers, I think, is what the kids understand. But yeah,
at Marvel, it's Imagineers.
Oh, Imagineers. And it's like,
good to know.
The way I don't know. I think I want Akira to be the first one that we recommend. That's my pick. Because everyone's seen the anime and the compositions and the drawings are like, it overcomes that problem that Chip just mentioned, where it's like he would look at it and be like, oh, I'm an adult. I don't want to watch bouncy, cartoony, whatever stuff. I want, I want the death, the high cost of living miniseries, which is bouncy and cartoony for Vertigo, which you probably didn't think at the time. I certainly didn't. But looking back at it now, it's like, this is night and day away from like a Mike Drinnenberg Sandman issue.
It's true.
You know, so yeah, I think Akira would be a good first one. That, and it's omnipresent. It's super available now everywhere except for digital. So that's funny.
Which may change in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it'll probably change. And the action is the kind of thing that I think, Chip, if you want this to be a thing where you learn and it makes you a better storyteller, the storytelling in this, particularly the action scenes, is incredible. So that's my pick for first book. But David, Deb, what do you guys think?
I own 2.5 complete copies of Akira in different formats. So like I'm in the bag. But it's interesting because I feel like at the same time, it's sort of like recommending Watchmen to a newbie comics reader. And that it's really good. Like, it's legitimately one of the best of the form. But it's not necessarily everyone's taste. So I'm wondering what Chip is going to like about it, what he'll latch on to. Because, like, the drawings are really good. The stories, there's so many different angles to appreciate it from. But also possibly angles that are more off-ramps than on-ramps.
Yeah.
The art's really, like, I feel like Akira is appealing, is a multinational appeal. It kind of like the art-wise and story-wise, it's a little bit like French bande dessinée, like heavy metal. It's beautifully architecturally drawn. It's impeccable. It's like from a pure art point of view, as someone who draws comics, you can look and go, like, holy shit, this guy can draw. You know? And the way it's super dynamic, and it's the way the story unfolds I don't feel like anything is telegraphed ahead of time. Like every bit of it, like you're reading it, like what's going to happen next? I don't get it. You know, like, and it throws you off. Like, maybe it's a little bit like Game of Thrones in that it's been such a big cultural touchstone that you already know a lot of the story. Mm-hmm. That, or like there's certain touchstone scenes where you go, oh, yeah, yeah, the part where he mutates and turns into this big blobby blah blah.
Or he's like, yeah, it's like,
oh, yeah,
something.
That part, you know, or like, yeah. Oh, there's this kid, you know. But, or yeah, he's on this motorcycle and he does this amazing drift turn, you know, like you know all this stuff.
Yeah. I watched the anime in high school at the behest of my manga friend. I don't remember anything from it.
I will say that the anime doesn't make a lot of sense.
well, that's another one of my questions. Like how many volumes is Akira?
Well, that's what
six.
I will show you.
Oh wait, Deb's got the all right. The good version here.
Yeah.
Ooh. I like the sound of her lifting it is good for the audio of all this.
It is a brick.
Wow.
It's okay, I gotta turn it around.
Okay.
Hey, don't drop it. Are you gonna be okay?
Yeah, I'm gonna be fine.
All right, so I'm looking right now. Six volumes.
Six
heavy volumes.
Yeah.
This is hardcover.
So what did the movie cover?
I'd say it was an abbreviation of the
2 and 3.
Up until 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And then the ending is not quite what you read in the manga.
Okay. So
it kind of is.
Okay. So I've got another question. I'm already into the questions. So Akira, massive success in all formats. The movie adapted volume 1 through 3. So why is there not an Akira 2 that adapts 4 through 6?
The movie adapted 1 through 3, but ended the same story that was begun in volume 1, if that makes sense. Like, the movie is an alternate version of the manga.
Okay, all right.
With its not a straight adaptation. Unique ending.
Yeah, and if this helps any, like, they announced at an anime expo in 2019 that they're going to do a reboot where he's working with Sunrise to do a complete end-to-end animated version of Akira that basically tells the whole story.
Mm. Oh.
As an animated series, because it's like that's 6 effing volumes. Mm-hmm. How are you going to fit that in 90 minutes?
Yeah.
And so a lot of the critique of the Akira anime is that they've made a lot of edits and they got rid of some of, like, I think Spike was saying this, Spike Trotman was saying that there are a lot of strong, interesting female characters in the Akira manga that basically got edited out, or their role or their strengths or whatever. Just kind of got
maybe
pushed to the side.
That's why I didn't care much for the Akira anime, because I knew subconsciously.
But I love this stuff. I mean, when Felix had like the art for sale, I went and I immediately had to buy some. But it's like these are like the colored pages.
Oh, those are the Steve. Okay. So those are the Steve Olive color guides. Yeah. He did by hand for the color separations of the Marvel Akira. I regret not getting any of those. Those are so nice.
I bought 2 at Ape. Like,
I'm so jealous because he was sending them for nothing at Ape.
Yeah, I was broke, and I think I walked into that con with like $50 in my bank account, and walked out with $5 in my bank account, and had 2 Akira pages.
I feel that. I think. To address all of your issues and compliments, I think that you're right. I think that there's a lot in Akira that is off-rampy as much as it's on-rampy, and the length is one of it. And it's one of the things that I think people do find intimidating. I think Chip, you know, mentioned he finds intimidating about stuff. So yeah, what I want to say about it, Akira, is that I think that the story does appeal, particularly these days. And it's why I think we can just, you know, in our sort of proto book club format, just read the first volume and see if, you know, Chip is hooked. And then if he likes it, maybe we can discuss volume 2 or volume 3 on later episodes, that sort of thing.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But the story specifically starts with the point of view of, it's about lots of things, but it's about two rival groups of punk kids, teenagers, maybe people in their early 20s, in Tokyo after there's been a nuclear attack, And which derails, basically a disaster that derails the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. In this book, written in 1986, and these two rival gangs are in a motorcycle fight, and then they end up sort of stumbling into a government operation that is much bigger than they are, much bigger than their petty squabbles.
All right, let's not spoil too much because I do want to read it.
That is the first 20 pages.
First of all,
this bad
boy. I don't care for teens,
yeah,
so it's going to be hard for me to get into this, but I'll do my best. But
they're pretty saucy, pretty unapologetically drug addicts.
Yeah, they're awful. not all drug addicts are awful, but these kids are particularly awful.
Yeah,
I like my teens clean and sober and following the rules. So
I think it was like writer. The '80s or '90s, and this was like right before big rave culture.
Yeah,
so It kind of like nicely meshed in with this. Oh yeah, let's just take handfuls of pills and have a good time.
To address some of the points you guys were talking about, I think that the nice thing about this, and I think the thing that makes it good for people who are already on board about comics, because a lot of people are not necessarily even on board about comics, let alone manga, is that, Deb, you were saying Game of Thrones or something like that, it's a thoroughly conceived world. You start reading this, like Watchmen even, you start reading this, and you're like, no, this is a world that 100% exists within this book. It does not feel like they're making it up as they go along. It doesn't rely on saying there's a mystery because they haven't written the end yet. This isn't Lost, you know, it's or Heroes or most 2000s must see TV. It's really good at doing that. And I think that that's the kind of thing where it is very grounded and it does keep hooking you in little ways. And it's unlike Moore, who I actually really like the work of Alan Moore a lot. I have like a whole shelf. But I think he likes to show you how much he knows with his work. He likes to be like, this is all the research I've done. And Otomo, I think the author of Akira, likes to do that as well, but visually rather than in the story. Yeah. The story is very ground level. It's all dialogue driven. There's no captions in the whole or thought balloons or anything. It is not
yes.
It is just... it is just you're in this world. And he shows off all the things he knows through the art. And I feel like that makes, and this is not a knock on, the artist of The Watchmen.
Dave Gibbons.
Thank you, David Gibbons. this is not a knock on David Gibbons. He's an amazing artist who can show you what he knows as well. That spinning bottle in Watchmen is ridiculous. Anyway, long story short, I think... the off-ramps are the same off-ramps that are in contemporary adult golden age of television. Like, yeah, a lot of people stopped watching Game of Thrones after Red Wedding. There's stuff like that in here. There's, like, some not great sexual stuff. There's a lot of drug use. There's a lot of, like, very violent, abusive situations, particularly at the school. And it's, like, that is absolutely a thing that is, like, very trigger warning-y, but I think is also perfectly in line with the kind of television, for the most part, that's become popular over the last decade. And that's why I think that maybe, you know, I think in the second half, when you get into the, like, like post-apocalypse, paramilitary, whatever, it becomes a very different story. But that first, the first volume especially is so realistically grounded and will get you on board for a much longer ride. You know what I mean? Okay. That lasts, that I think at the end of the first volume, you're not like, yeah, I really want to know actually what happens next. Then, yeah, Akira's not for you. If you're like, no, I don't really care about any of this, like, I think the best possible job they could have done, they did in getting you into this world. And then from there, it's up to you to take the baton that they've passed you.
So here's a general manga question for you as well, in terms of, like, from volume to volume. Are they as big into cliffhangers as American comics?
More so.
It varies, and some of them are different types of cliffhangers. Like, sometimes a cliffhanger is an emotional realization, and other times it's like, well, this sword is like an inch away from this guy's face, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And the answer is like, he dodges somehow. So it's kind of...
again, no spoilers.
Yeah.
I gotta ask you, Chris, you have the Dark Horse edition with you? Is it flipped?
It is flipped. It's in the North American orientation. And yours, I don't... Oh, yours is unflipped.
It's a Japanese... It's in a Japanese order.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. And David, you said you have 2.5. Which editions do you have?
So I've got some of the Marvel trade paperbacks they did, the 2-in-1 single issues. I've got 2 of the Graffiti Designs hardcovers that collects those.
Wow.
I've got 1 of the Barnes & Noble exclusive hardcover of Volume 1.
Nice.
That I think just uses like the Dark Horse translation.
Yeah.
And then I've got the Kodansha box set that came out a couple years ago.
Maybe
and like the translations are slightly different, like the sound effects are completely different between two editions.
I didn't know that. They did new translations?
Yeah.
I think Dark Horse used the French sound effects translations.
Oh.
Which is such like a nothing thing to notice in a comic book, but it is different.
Huh.
Just because it's changed hands so many times over the years with different publishers and things like that.
Oh yeah, Editions Glenat is listed as the sound effects lettering. Alongside the North American dude, David.
Yeah. Interesting.
Edition Glenat. Sorry to the French people who listen to me say Editions Glenat.
But that, I think that's part of the fun of it is that if, like, as a comics maker, I think you'd have a different perspective on a lot of this stuff as well, especially the craft aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like Akira is one of those comics that's sort of like your favorite artist drew this back in the day.
Yes, yes, of course.
See, I wish I could recommend a much more accessible entry to Otomo's work, which is Domo.
Mm-hmm.
But Domo is out of print,
yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah, Domo is one volume.
One short volume, too, like 250 or something like that? 250 pages?
Yeah, it's really short.
How? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so wild to me that something like that would be out of print then. Like, you know, it created like the most popular manga
ever. It's largely him.
Yeah.
It's largely really? Otomo's decision.
Otomo's is like Alan Moore in lots of different ways.
Oh, okay. Let's put it that way. I get it. Yeah.
But apparently they just announced in Japan that he's going back, and they announced this at Anime Expo, that he's going back in and re-editing, or they're going to release his entire output.
Mm.
Okay.
And there's a lot of books that he did, short stories and other series, that aren't available in English ever. Or at least not legally, that are going to be released. So Domo will come back. If you're lucky and you find it, like the Dark Horse edition, it's very good. But it has all the great art of Akira. It's a much shorter story. It's about a housing project. And then there's a girl who moves in and she's psychic. But there's another person in the housing project who is also psychic and is... raising havoc, like doing things to make mischief, and leads to murder, and there's all kinds of mysterious things happening. So it ends up being like
horror.
Yeah, kind of, but it's kind of cool.
Like
it ends up being like this battle between this young girl and this old man.
It's really good.
That's interesting.
It could be an X-Men story, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it was actually ripped off for a movie that was it Chronicle, maybe.
Oh, that's it.
I'd have to look up that before I make any scandalous, libelous declarations.
But that's kind of some of the same vibe of Akira. The art's still great. There's that architectural aspect, but then these epic, sweeping aerial scenes of these buildings and these amazing, one of the signatures of Otomo is that moment when someone gives a psychic blast, and like it's like a ball, like a force ball that just slams that person against the wall.
Yeah.
this psychic force that just, and then at least like this dome shaped imprint in the wall.
Oh yeah,
oh shit, it's Domu, by the way. We've been saying Domo, I think.
Domu.
Whoops.
You're supposed to be teaching me. Unbelievable.
You know, no one's infallible.
Because I think a Domu is kind of, maybe it's kind of like a play on dorm.
That would be interesting. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, what do you guys think? Chip, have we sufficiently convinced you to try at least the first volume of Akira?
Yeah, okay.
Ooh, we're going to have a podcast, people. That's good.
Yeah.
So, I'm curious to hear what you think about it, because you know, there's no obligation for you to read all of it, but I'd love to see if it hooks you in.
It'd just be funny, like, just listening to David recount all the various editions he's got of this, and then I come on and go, yeah, it wasn't for me.
You know what Akira reminds me a little bit of in terms of, like, its immersiveness in the art is the Inkle. Have you read The Angel by Mobius?
Yeah, I can see that.
No, I haven't.
He and Mobius were friends as well.
Yeah, very similar style.
We're going to have to get somebody to do a European comics version of this podcast that also has you on.
You haven't read The Inkle?
But it's okay if you don't like it, because when I watched Blade Runner, it was less good to me because I'd seen Akira and watched it 100 times as a kid. They cover some of the similar ground. And I was like, I get it. Okay, he's a robot. Like, obviously.
I don't even know, like, why I should even be saying this, but, like, it's called Incal? I-N-C-A-L?
Yeah. I'll grab it. I'll show you.
Yeah, I think, like, because Mark Waid is in charge of the humanoid stuff, and I think he approached me to do, like, a sequel to Inkle or something. And I was like, no, that's okay, because I had no idea what it was.
It's a pretty good Mobius book. You might want to read it someday, like, if you're up for it.
Yeah, I mean, I've read some Mobius. Obviously, the Silver Surfer issue.
Yeah, same.
This stuff is so good. Like, when we went to see the Mobius exhibit in Germany, it was just, you could see, like, a lot of the original pages, and there's a lot of scenes in here that are is equally iconic.
Yeah, Mobius is one of those creators where I've looked at their art a ton. Like, I study the art. I just haven't really read the books.
Mm. Yeah.
This one's different because it's not by him. It's by Jodorowsky.
Jodorowsky, yeah.
Yeah. So the story is super spacey and interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe I'll call Mark back and say I'll do Inkle too.
Just, you guys send me all the, you guys send me the copies first.
Yeah.
And technically Inkle 4.
All right. Yeah. Oh, wow. Sure, yeah. Thanks. Thanks, Chris.
No problem. okay, so we are wrapping the end of an hour of recording time, which I think is, like, we can edit this down about 15 minutes. It'll be really good.
perfect.
But yeah, so let's all take a moment. Let's relax and think about how we're going to acquire a copy of Akira Volume 1. I imagine there are many local bookstores and local comic stores that would be happy to deliver to Chip, but also to anyone who's listening here who wants to read along with us before the next episode to see what you think. But yeah, we're going to do Volume 1. Hopefully you like it. Hopefully that means we can do future volumes and future episodes. And we'll get back together then. But in closing, I wanted to give everyone, because we did sort of general introductions when we started, I wanted to give everyone a chance to talk a little bit about where people can find you all online if you want to be found, or if you want to talk about a new project or a new piece of work that you've got coming out. So again, starting from my right is Deb. Deb, what have you been up to?
Not a lot. I basically have my day job stuff. So
I just saw a commercial on Instagram with you in it from Viz talking about the the new fangirl meditation they're doing. So you're everywhere. You're like in my Instagram feed, which was pretty fun, and my Facebook feed too. Just like a video of you talking about the book.
Oh my God, that's so embarrassing.
Oh, sorry there.
I can't even watch that video. I hate seeing myself in video.
But
I will say that the fangirl manga is worth checking out. I enjoyed it.
Chip, what have you got coming up these days?
I wrapped up Sex Criminals, my series through Image, and the third and final hardcover volume, Big Hard Sex Criminals Volume 3, is coming out, I think, in April.
Nice.
And currently I'm still working on Daredevil for Marvel and a few other things that I can't talk about.
Well, you've got a series coming out through Skybound, through Image, too, as well, right?
Yep. Yeah, I can never remember which ones are actually out and which ones I'm not supposed to talk about. So yeah, thank you, Chris. I have a horror comic called Stillwater, which is out through Skybound right now. And they announced I'm doing a Batman story, a Batman anthology coming up called Urban Legends, which is fun. It's fun to write Batman.
Cool.
Is it true that those are just your first few Daredevil scripts with Batman written in instead of Daredevil?
Kind of.
Nothing wasted.
Yeah. Daredevil with money.
It's true.
And David, what would you like to shout out?
I've got this new podcast called Manga Splaining that you're listening to right now.
I heard it's good.
Yeah. I don't have much going on right now. I probably will a little bit later this year.
Aren't you editing Fist of the North Star?
No, I'm actually not editing it, but a coworker of mine is editing Fist of the North Star, which I'm really excited about. It's the, we're getting the manga, the original manga that the anime was based on, released in the US again, for the first time in like 20, 25 years. Wow. But like complete set, hard covers. I'm really excited to not work on it and to just get to read it. I feel like that'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But for things I do work on, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Diamond is Unbreakable is one of mine. We've got Hell's Paradise Jigoku Raku coming out. That's really fun. Kind of like a horror ninja action drama. Yeah, Chip, one thing you'll find as we discuss all of this manga is that everything's like a multi-genre chimera.
Yeah. I was just thinking, I'm really looking forward to us discussing manga that you've edited.
Yeah.
That's going
to
be fun.
Oh my God. Can you imagine trying to explain JoJo's to Chip?
Oh, it's super easy. One guy is such a huge dick to this family for 150 years, and they all have superpowers.
No, that's a story I can get behind.
And they pose really interestingly.
Yeah.
Great. I'm in.
You're super fashionable. You can watch
from my comic.
Yeah. I like how we were just supposed to talk about what we're working on, and now we're still
talking about
doing the podcast.
We can't help it.
Chris, what do you have cooking?
Yeah.
Welcome to Manga Splaining. No, I'm taking some time off, and it's real nice, I gotta say. I recommend, if you're feeling burnt out, take some time off before you have to. That's today's bit of manga advice. I'm actually enjoying reading comics again for the first time in a little while. I kind of got burnt out on reading comics, so this is a nice way to get back into it, as well as just, you know, I have access to literally every book that is published through The Beguiling, so...
What are you reading now?
The last one I read was the, I can't remember the exact title because it's a famous title, but it's The Frog at the Bottom of the Well Doesn't Know the Ocean, and it's a Yen Press series that's coming out.
I just read that the other day.
I really liked it.
It's great.
It's a slice of life story about a guy who's a comic creator who keeps trying to come up with his next hit, and they keep getting worse and worse and worse until he realizes that he's just like trying to mine the same ground that he's always known. And that's the problem.
Oh, God.
He starts to look into his life to see other experiences and realizes, oh, this is what I should be doing. Anyway, it's really good. I highly recommend it to people who like manga about manga.
So it sounds like a horror book for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're reading this as a break from life?
I like it because isn't it kind of semi-autobiographic? Because it's about the guy who, it's by the guy who did Barakamon. Right?
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. It is. Sorry. It took me a sec. Anyway, it's good. I can't wait for the second one.
Barakamon is kind of like Mayberry meets Steinfeld. It's like this, like, and Green Acres, you know, like this city guy goes to this small island and then he basically gets adopted by all the eccentric locals.
Mm.
You know what?
So that was Barakamon, and then like this one is about a guy who grew up on a small island, and then he makes manga about living on a small island.
You know what, gang? I think this is going to be a good podcast.
You'll like it. It's really good. It's like a midlife crisis, but Bakuman.
All right. On that note, if you need something new to read that isn't Akira, the Frog at the Bottom of the Well Doesn't Know the Sea. On behalf of David and Deb and Chip, I'd like to thank you all so very much for tuning into the episode zero of Manga Splaining, and we hope we'll see you back for episode number one. Thanks very much. Bye, guys. This has been Manga Splaining, episode number zero. Thanks for listening. For our next and first official episode, we'll be discussing the manga Akira, Volume 1, by Katsuhiro Otomo, published by Kodansha Comics. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com. Thanks so much to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.